The Buddha was grieved. He had been raised, He had been raised in a sheltered life, but discovered outside his palatial home the truths of the world, illness and old age, suffering and death. He sat for years contemplating his experience and the resultant anxiety, and then, as if a light bulb had been switched on, he said, "Wide open the door of the deathless to all who have ears to hear. Let them send forth faith to meet it." This affirmation speaks to us of a different kind of faith than that to which much of our culture refers. Some here grow to have faith in God, and such faith is a matter of belief. Some grow to have faith in humanity, and that too is an assertion about which there may be conflicting evidence. Others make faith statements such as, "Trust the process," an affirmation that's usually made by those for whom the process has yielded the result that benefited them. But "wide open is the door" speaks about the condition of the listener, for those who have ears to hear, with the instruction that the response to the opening of the door is a willingness to step in, the willingness to exhibit confidence and trust and faith. Faith then becomes not a matter of belief, but a matter of the will, a matter of a choice to exhibit moral judgment, to step in and be willing to look among various options and to choose again and again a middle path. The door of the deathless is open to all who have ears to hear. Let them step in. Let them exhibit a confidence in the way. Let them take refuge in the leadership of the Buddha. Let them take refuge in the truth of right action, thought, and being. Let them take refuge in community. The door of the deathless is open wide, even as a great teacher of the Buddhist way is close to the door of death. And this past month, the Plum Village community in France announced that Thich Nhat Hanh is nearing the end of this episode of his life. At 88 years old, he had become frail, and early in November was admitted to the hospital for care. About a week ago, he suffered a brain hemorrhage. And while he is still responsive and shows indication that he is aware of the presence of those around him, his communities around the world are organizing practice sessions to generate the energy of mindfulness and to hold their beloved teacher in this energy. This healing energy, this loving energy, this regenerative energy, this energy of letting go. Our practice of stability and peace in this very moment, is what the community says, is the best support we can offer to Thich Nhat Hanh. Thich Nhat Hanh is revered the world over for developing the notion of engaged Buddhism, a practice of Buddhism developed during the wars in Vietnam. His belief that there was more to Buddhist practice than meditation, charity work, and koan study, but that Buddhism needed to engage the people of Vietnam and France and the United States and the whole world to end the wars in and against Vietnam and to create the conditions of mindfulness, stability, and maybe even peace. Thich Nhat Hanh developed the notion of interbeing, a sense that none of us has any being without all of us having being. I am connected to you in ways that neither of us can understand. My intentions and actions change who you are, and yours change me. We have no choice in this. Interbeing says that we simply inter-are. We can't get beyond it. I am connected to you, and you are connected to me, and the future of everything depends on how we interbe together. More than just reading his philosophical statements and even that manual of the order of interbeing and his practical instructions toward achieving mindfulness, first published by our own printing house, Beacon Press, back in the 60s, I've been rereading some of Thich Nhat Hanh's fiction. Fiction that they say mirrors the way that Thich Nhat Hanh taught. During his Dharma talks, he always included the children for the first 20 minutes or so. The first 20 minutes or so would be directed toward the children of the community, who would then be invited to leave and go take part in age-appropriate activities. And then he'd return to his session with the adults, and they were prepared, because they had listened to the children's story, to be able to listen in a deeper way to what was being said. The story Peony Blossoms is written for young readers. And unlike other fiction that he's written, this takes place entirely in Europe. It takes place in France, where a Vietnamese family has taken refuge during the wars. This family includes a physicist, father, Do An, a homemaker mother, Tu Yet, her artist brother, Uncle Tang, and an 8-year-old boy, Ti. The lives of this family are filled with the possibilities that exist in Europe, of education and peace, of the possibility of long lives not cut short by warfare, even of the possibility of an artist living very simply, to be free to make art for the sake of art. Yet the family wants never to forget Vietnam, never to forget the richness and joy of their lives in earlier days, nor the resilience and capacity and even suffering of their people. Uncle Tang, the artist, meditates, and after 20 minutes of paying attention to his breath, he allows his mind to go where it wants to go. Tang began to see images of himself in the village along the riverbank where he had grown up. It was a small village crossed by the Huajiang River in the province of Luoyang. Rich, immense rice fields flourished along both sides of the river. As a child, Tang had run barefoot with his friends on the dikes of those rice fields, digging for earthworms, catching fish, setting shrimp traps, and hunting for black crickets. What had become of those friends? Some had died on battlefields. Others were in re-education camps. Others, he had learned, had simply vanished without a trace. He knew that Quay, his oldest friend, closest friend in grade school, had been killed in the river of the Plaine. His body must be one with the earth by now, Tang thought. Many boys of the younger generation had been killed by bullets and bombs. His own nephew, Thi, was more fortunate. Although both his parents were Vietnamese, he had been born in France. His collective karma was linked with other Vietnamese children, but his personal karma set him apart, providing him with advantages that children in Vietnam couldn't even imagine. The advantages of their karma do not prevent them from suffering. This 8-year-old boy, Thi, was ill, sick, with a high fever, and brought to a hospital when the doctor's assurance, "Take 2 aspirin and call me in the morning," proved to be unwise. The fever rises. 103 degrees Fahrenheit, 104. By the time they reached the hospital, 105. When the hospital insists that only one parent may remain in the room with the boy, Father Doan goes home for a sleepless night, and there he ponders the meaning of existence. The clock on the wall struck midnight. Doan put on his pajamas and got into bed, hoping he could just drop off to sleep. But he could not even close his eyes. Then, only then, did he slowly and clearly begin to see the true face of his inner disquiet. The image of T kept appearing before him. He trembled as he thought of his son's mortality. He tossed and turned, trying to find a position which might be more restful, to no avail. His bed was on fire, too. He felt as if he, Tuyeti, their entire house, were floating on the ocean and could be capsized by a wave at any moment. It was the first time he realized how entwined T's life was with his own. He saw that if T died, he would no longer be himself. He would also die. T was more than just his son. T was himself. Doan's discovery was remarkable. T was not only his son, but T was Doan himself. Were T to die, Doan too would die. Even if Doan did not actually die, he could only be a shadow of his former self. What a shocking insight. How could he ever fall asleep now that he knew this? He was like a man shot by an arrow. The shock, the pain, the reality of it all was so strong, he could not even shut his eyes. Doan gave up trying to sleep. He went to the kitchen to make a strong cup of black coffee. Two men then lose much sleep that night, father and uncle, wondering what is happening for son and nephew. They meet in the morning and set out for the hospital. Last night was an eternity, he said. Time, my time, T's time, the time of electrons and mesons, is the time of the physical sciences independent of the time of the human mind? More than once, Doan had pondered and talked with Tang about the subject of time. They had discussed time and Einstein's theory of relativity, and Tang had observed that time, space, and what we call physical phenomena have an intimate relationship with human perception. Tang had said that only through the human mind do these acquire the forms and natures by which we usually know them. Doan could almost totally agree with Tang. Recent discoveries in subatomic physics had all but brought down the whole edifice of materialist physics, so that the very foundation of existence presumed since Democritus had lost its credibility. Scientists were unable to find anything that had a separate, independent existence. Whenever they conducted subatomic experiments, they were able to record only the entity's reactions, sometimes as waves, sometimes as particles. They could not locate a self. They could only locate their own conception. So what is this self? And can we ever tell? Are we ever able to know who we are, each of us? Or are we only able to record our reactions? As we inter are we only a community? Am I able to be who I am without you? Are you able to be who you are without me? Or are we so in each other that we shape each other, we encourage each other, we enrage each other, we engage each other, and the world with which we enter are. This community, this congregation, is not separable from this neighborhood. We enter are with our neighbors. A neighbor sent these words to our leaders. I'm writing to tell you that a young man died on the sidewalk in front of your church. It was a cold morning on Thursday, and I was on my morning walk. When I crossed Franklin at 7:30 a.m., I saw in front of your building what looked like a pile of clothes, perhaps trash, I wasn't sure. As I continued north on Charles, something made me turn back to investigate. I then saw the top of this man's head and saw that he was half covered by a sleeping bag. He was wearing one shoe. I spoke to him but received no answer. A woman was standing about half a block away and told me she had just called 911 for some help. It was a busy morning with lots of foot traffic. She and I were sad to see that many were passing and no doubt had passed before we stopped. I stayed with the man and prayed until the paramedics and the police arrived. The medics performed CPR and used a defibrillator twice before taking him away. It was incredibly sad. What struck me was the image of a thin, vulnerable man dying from cold outside the gate of a lovely church. If he had looked across the street, he would have seen the gated and locked prayer garden commemorating the visit of Pope John Paul II to Baltimore. I, myself, am a parishioner of the Episcopal Cathedral of the Incarnation on University Parkway, and know this same scene could have played out at any of our churches. I thought you would want to know that this happened outside of yours. What does it mean that the doors of our teaching are wide open to those who have ears and can hear? This faith we share, this Unitarian Universalist faith of ours, insists on the interconnectedness of all things. One of the principles around which we associate says that we affirm and promote respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. This web of our faith is not unlike Indra's web, the notion shared by the religions of South Asia that creation is a net, infinite in scope. That at the center of an infinite number of spaces, openings in the net, is a diamond with an infinite number of facets, and that each facet is the reflection of every other diamond. Infinity in infinity by infinity, this web of existence is us. This suffering soul dying on Franklin Street is us. This beloved teacher at the end of his incarnation is us. And somehow in our faith, brothers and sisters, we are called with one another to be about mindfulness, good intention, right action, and supreme peace. May it be so. Blessed be. Ashe, ashe. Amen.
Do you remember the day our mother? Good morning. My name is Fulman Paul. I'm from the UNMC. This is the Institute. This is my first time. 2 years ago, I was here also. I met the pastor. Thank you.
Let's see, how do we get it? Oh, well, also, you can visit. Prime Inn to help transform the building from the church over to Day Spring and to help set up the boutique. And then we need volunteers all day Saturday to work with us in the boutique. When we say all day, what time are we talking about, Karen?
We don't have time, so definitely we'll get it tomorrow.
All right. That's great. Great. So please speak to Karen or me or others at the social media community house around taking the ship to the boutique or out to transport clothing. I'm going to invite us to take a deep breath and to let it out. Take another deep breath. Let it out. And final deep breath. And let it out. And you will take your final breath at this moment. And I'll do it in a deep breath. Could you please rise? Hold someone's hand and be attentive to the chalice.
We extinguish this chalice, but not the light of truth, the warmth of community, or the fire of commitment. These we carry in our hearts until we are together again. Our closing song is Forward Through the Ages. It's in the Grand Hymnal.